Okay. Basically, what I'm starting out with is how things used to be probably 30, 40, maybe 50 years back when people came up with this abbreviation RAM, which means random access memory, which was more or less to explain that it is not like a tape where you have to seek for possibly hours to get to a certain location and then you can read or write it. The idea of RAM was that you can write it at any random location and it is fast, or more specifically, it takes the same time no matter what you do, which used to be true. And well, who still believes this is true? Anyone? Good. What? Oh.
Even 6.02 is faster to access page 0 than it was to access any other page.
Actually, I checked. The Cray 1 already had this problem. So it's an old problem. But still, a lot of the textbook algorithms assume that every memory access is the same. So most of these algorithms are based on a an assumption that is, well, antique. In short, I used to have lots of reasons why this is not true anymore. The short answer to that is read Ulrich Brethers' papers on Linux Weekly News. He did 5 or 6 parts, excellent work. You will probably take a week or so to read it all, but it's worth it. Do it if you haven't done it already. Yeah. Just for some more tiny examples to get the point across, the memory latency of the Cray 1 was actually quite good. This is main memory. They had, I believe it was 128 megabytes or something like that. I'm not quite sure. The memory latency of the most recent DDR3 1600 whatnot that I don't have in any machine yet is, well, the fastest ones are almost as good as the Cray 1. That's progress of 35 years. We're getting better. Moore's law is in action in some places. The bandwidth actually has gotten a lot better, but the latency still sucks as much as it used to, actually more. And it's currently, well, depending on which generation of RAM you have today, it's somewhere between 50 and 100 nanoseconds usually. It keeps getting better and worse and better and worse, so it's somewhere in that area. And basically, if you take a look at RAM, it is a high latency, high bandwidth device. Just like the network, just like a disk. In a way, any algorithm that used to be designed for a disk 20 years back is probably a good algorithm to be used on memory today. And we still have this low latency device, which is called the L1 cache. And maybe even lower latency is the registers. The Cray 1 had low latency registers and then somewhat higher latency RAM, and now we have several stages of cache in between. But that's more or less what it's like. And I actually did steal one slide from Ulrich, because this one slide can explain almost all of what problems you get with memory. Basically, he wrote a program that is accessing a certain data set. And we have two lines. The red line at the bottom is accessing all data sequentially. The blue line on the top is going randomly through the complete data set, which, as you might expect, is taking a bit longer. And you have the cycles, the CPU cycles, you need to access one element. And up to the power of 13 or 14, you are staying within your level 1 cache, which means it takes, I believe the number is 3 cycles, something like that, but those 3 cycles actually get hidden in the CPU pipeline, so it's effectively immediate access for practical purposes. If you take a look at the red line, you take a small step when you go into the L2 cache, but then it stays plain even when you access into main memory, because the CPU is doing a really good job at prefetching the memory before you have to access it. So This is true for any remotely modern CPU. As long as you access your memory sequentially, prefetching is doing a great job to hide the latency. When you're going randomly, then even for the L2 cache, prefetching is not working anymore, and you get a small hit. And up to, I believe, a megabyte or so was the L2 cache, so that's the 2 to the power of 20 line where you spill over the L2 cache, and you hit main memory, which is a big step. And then again, you run out of the TLBs, which is not a problem for the kernel so much. And when you run out of TLBs, you again take a hit. And in the end, you are somewhere near 500 cycles to get a single word out of memory, which is fairly slow. You can do a lot of calculations within 500 cycles. So in other words, once you, your data set has grown large enough, it doesn't matter what you're doing with the data. It only matters in which order you access it. And there's a second thing. There's one more thing that is not available in the slide so much. This is a really crappy picture of what a cache may look like. Basically, you have a cache line that is more than one byte, and you have a small tag at the, in the beginning, which contains the address and a bit to say that this cache line is dirty and needs to be written back, and a bit to say that this is up to date and you can actually read it and don't have to go back, and something like that. And actually, just to show Christoph that I am a real hacker, I have written this great test program in VI. And probably you can't read it that well. Is this better? Okay. Say again? Colors off. Okay. Basically, half of this program is prep just to do some printouts. And the interesting stuff, I have the very carefully designed constant to set the size of a two-dimensional array as the two-dimensional array itself. I have some small initialization, which is just writing some random value into each field. And I have the main loop, which is calculating something from this two-dimensional array. In this case, the sum of all elements inside the array. I don't use the sum. I don't care what is happening with it at all. I just want to access the data in some order. And this program contains one significant bug. Anyone who can spot it yet? It might, but it doesn't. Yes? Okay. We'll see the effect of this. It is doing the initialization that is finished fairly quickly, and then it takes a while to do the actual loop. And surprisingly, the loop takes longer, the working loop that is only reading the data takes longer than the writing loop in the initialization, which should actually read and write and should take a longer time because of this bug. Basically, what I was doing, we should take a quick look back, I was indexing in the wrong order, and the effect of this was that I would read the very first byte out of one cache line, then read the very first byte of the second cache line, and so on and so on. I would waste all the other data in the cache line, then go back and read the very first byte in the second, the second byte in the first cache line, and so on, and run through one cache line for every single byte I access, which, as one might expect, is slow. So we can just fix this bug real quick. Run it again, and initialization didn't change, and whoops. As expected, the working loop is faster than the initialization. And we are down from 3 seconds, from 8 and some seconds to 3 seconds. And most of the time spent in the initialization, which didn't change at all. So basically, we have a more or less a factor of 10, give or take a bit, in performance for this simple effect. And if you do matrix multiplication, one of the most important tricks to ever do is to flip the matrix, one of the two matrices you are multiplying, so that you do access both matrices in the right order. It can be a factor of more than 10 in performance easily. And that's the difference between a 19-inch rack and this laptop, more or less. I prefer the laptop on my lap. So, okay. With that, we have more or less an idea of what memory behaves like. And we go ahead and forget everything we ever learned about this O notation, O log N, O N squared, because in my opinion, it completely blinds your eye for what's really going on, as it also assumes that every single axis is of the same order, takes the same time. And this is simply not true. So instead, I take an example that I will handle just a million objects, a reasonably large number. So if any algorithm is inefficient with a million objects, we should notice this. And I'm not going to go through every single possible data structure we have. I just want to manage this data structure. I want to insert new elements, remove elements from the set, and do a lookup by some name, number, whatever. And I'm looking at memory overhead, because as we remember, the smaller the data set, the faster things work. And I care about cache misses. I don't care about memory access, I care about cache misses, which is something different. As long as I hit the L1 cache, the memory access is for free. Only the accesses that go beyond cache are the ones I care about.
How do you measure those?
I calculate them. I didn't measure. I didn't write any example code beyond the crappy stuff. And most likely, actually, there will be lots of errors in the slides that are following. Some are deliberate. Some may not be deliberate. If you find any errors, shout out. Heckle. I decided to build my own example machine, which is fairly close to current Intel or AMD CPUs. It's a 32-bit machine. Cache line size is 128 bytes, which most modern machines also have. Cache line size tends to increase, so in a couple of years, we'll probably see larger cache lines. L1 cache has 16 kilobytes, which is also fairly common for machines, which means you have 512 cache lines in total. And L2 cache, 1 megabyte, is starting to become fairly small, but maybe with multicores, it will stay common for a while, which means we have about 8,000 cache lines. And yeah, I also took one very efficient data structure, the array. It is so efficient and so basic that you get support for it in every single programming language you will ever come across, probably. Well, almost every single one. Extra points for Willy. Almost anything has an array of some sort. And the array is our holy grail. That's where we want to go. Because it doesn't need to do anything to do a lookup. Not in a sequential case, not in a random access case, and worst case is, well, usually either sequential or random access. Sometimes it's something different. But basically, the lookup is for free. It still has to look up the actual object you have to read, but that's a given no matter what the data structure is. But for finding the object, for managing the object, it doesn't need to do any work at all. And you cannot get better than that. Well, looking up the object depends on how big is the object. And
I
Right. But the way I defined these numbers is the lookup of the object itself I consider for free, because you need to do it anyway. If you want to add a 1 to every single of those numbers, please do it in your head. You can see it one way or the other. How many pointers do we need per object, which is the memory overhead of managing all these objects? That's again perfect. We don't need any. We don't have any. How many objects fit into one cache line? In this case, I don't care how many actual objects fit into one cache line, but how many objects we can manage with one cache line. And that's an infinite number. The object itself usually fits into one or more cache lines, but that's a different question. I don't care about the object. I don't care if we are managing pages of DRAM, or if we are managing blocks in a file system, or if we are managing significant others. I don't care. The object itself is none of my business. And fanout is something we usually care about in a tree. But again, basically, fanout is you take a bowl of spaghetti and you grab one spaghetti. How many others are going to stick to it? That's your fanout. Whether that's a tree structure or something else doesn't matter. And again, you take one piece of the array and you have everything. So these are the perfect numbers, except you cannot insert and you cannot remove. The size of your array is fixed. You set it at compile time, and if you want to change it, the array doesn't work. So this is more or less disqualified. But this is the holy grail. We want to get close to it. And probably what people do next, usually in secondary school, maybe 10th grade or so, they find linked lists. Anyone here who has not implemented linked lists himself? Nobody? Okay. Thought so. Very basic, very crappy. You just take a single pointer in every object, and usually you have all the management code within the handling code for the objects, and it's really crappy. And, well, inserting an object into the list doesn't matter, and what you're doing is fairly fast. You just change two pointers, and one of them is always hot in the cache, so you don't do any cache misses. You have the object in the cache anyway, so that's for free. If you want to remove a particular object, on average, you will have to walk half the list, which is a million objects, so you will need 500,000 accesses, and you can pretty much bet that every single one of them will not be a cache hit. So this is going to be slow, and you cannot really get much worse, much further away from the holy grail. Look up the same. If you have some other means to get to the object, great. If you don't, it's going to take forever. For every single object, you need just one pointer. That's good. That's great. You have in every single cache line just one object because, well, the pointer is embedded into this huge object, and the object itself will occupy the rest of the cache line. So you don't expect to ever find two pointers in the same cache line. Your fanout is crappy, one. And theoretically, yes. I assume large objects. If you have smaller objects, then it may work better. Agreed. We will get to that in two data structures or three or four files. I guess you can hack it then. It's a good point, but not now. For the moment, I just assume the objects are huge enough to fill the whole cache line. If it's not, then I need to go into the special cases, and I'll like to keep it a little bit simple. And yeah, you do get some cache hits, so if you take the L2 cache hits, you can subtract about 8,000 from these numbers because you get the odd cache hit through sheer luck, but 500,000 subtracted by 8,000, that's still as close to 500,000 as you can be. It doesn't matter. The cache, well, actually, it does matter, because when you walk all these objects, you have effectively flushed your cache. Whatever useful data you had in the cache before is gone. Now it's filled by these objects from the list, and everything that is going to run after you did a lookup or a remove is going to be as slow as if the system had just booted up. So this is pretty much the worst data structure you can have ever, which is why most people past 10th grade don't use it anymore. And yes, you can have the linked list in two variants. Either you keep it unsorted or you keep it sorted. If you have it sorted, then your insertion will, well, as long as you keep it sorted in the right direction, your sequential insertion will be fast. But any random insertion, which you will usually have, will take, well, as long as you need to walk half the list on average. Lookup, again, as long as you are sequentially doing it, is fast. If you do it in any random order, it is crappy again. So it's basically just moving the cost around. And for some problems, this may be a better variant. For some problems, the other may be a better variant. For most problems, both are a bad choice. Pretty much for anything. And in both cases, remove is expensive. Whatever you do, remove is expensive, and it's going to flush your complete cache. It's getting more interesting here, because here we actually can get more objects from a single cache line. One of the possible next steps, not necessarily a good step, but one of the possible next steps is to remove the pointer from the object itself. Have the object contain only the data structures the object needs, and we manage this object through some other data structures. So now we need the next pointer to link the list, and we need a second pointer to point to the actual object. Disadvantage, we need two pointers instead of one. We doubled our memory overhead. But huge advantage, we can get about 16 of these structures into each cache line. And in the case of a linked list where the pointer is part of the object, if the object is small enough, we can also get more than one per cache line. Is this sufficient answer? Okay. And yes. We still have more or less the same numbers on the top. But we have two pointers per object. We have more overhead, but we get more objects per cache line. And we get significantly more L1 and L2 cache hits. You need memory allocations. That's for kernel code, that can be a big problem, yes. So you may need mempools, depending on where you're doing this. Definitely. Also, anyone spotting an error? What? The fanout is still one. When you have one object, you can only find the next object, not two or three. That's what? This is the one. You do get more objects per cache line, but you don't have any locality of access. The chance of finding the next object you're pointing to or the next structure you're pointing to in the same cache line is pretty much zero. So as long as you have only 8,000 or so objects, everything will fit into L1 cache, and you get cache hits. As long as you have less than 100,000 objects, everything will fit into L2 cache, and you get cache hits. With a million objects, well, your chances of finding cache hits is pretty much down to the occasional 1 out of 100 or so. So it's pretty much you don't get any cache hits either. And these numbers are too optimistic. For large numbers, the cache doesn't matter anymore, and you just flush it anyway. But you don't flush you get some cases where you don't flush the complete cache, but just half of it or so. So it is arguably a bit better. It's getting interesting because you can do more complicated stuff with the external handling. You can do a skip list. Basically, with the skip list, you create a second list. And this second list only links to every second or so object. So you can walk the second list faster than the basic list at the bottom. And when you grow more elements, you take a third list, and you simply point to every fourth object, to every one object in 8, one object in 16, and so on and so forth. And in this way, you do a bisect in a way of the list. And if you want to find any single object, you just walk the topmost list until you are past the object, go one back, take the next list down, walk, go back, and so on. So you turn the linear problem into a logarithmic problem, which is good. This is assuming a sorted list, yes. If the list is unsorted, you can dump the skip list and search for everything. Yes. If it is not sorted, then you are dead. And so basically, we should have a binary logarithm of a million, which is 20. Actually, we can get slightly better than that. You can also skip 4 elements instead of 2, in which case you would have to do more seeks, but you have fewer lists on the top and fewer steps down. And it turns out skipping 4 elements is just as efficient as skipping 2 elements. Skipping 3 elements, or skipping E elements to be exact, is the perfect one. Skipping E, well, is a bit hard to do, but there's also one more trick. When you insert an element, you would have to update all the lists on the top to get the perfect stride again. So instead of doing that, you don't take a fixed offset, but you take a fixed chance of inserting an object in the next list further up. Basically, when you insert an object on the bottom, you have a 50% chance of inserting the next object in the second list up, a 25% chance to do it one further up, and so on. So on average, you will have this stride of 2 elements. It may be you may have 3 objects in a row and then a small gap or something like that, but on average, it will even out. And yes, here I corrected the mistake from before. You do get 16 objects per cache line, but it doesn't help you much. The chances of finding any object you really care about on the same cache lines are nil. You need, depending on how big your stride is, if you take a stride of 2, you need 4 objects per 4 pointers per object. If you take a larger stride, you need less, and I think the limit is somewhere near 3 or pretty close to 3. If your stride is going larger, you need fewer pointers, but also you need more cache misses when you're doing your inserts and lookups. Actually, in this case, the cache is helping us significantly, and we can expect to find the top lists that are fairly short in L1 cache, and the next couple of lists that are reasonably short in L2 cache. And assuming that the cache belongs to us, and we're not doing anything else with it, we can expect to get 8 cache hits from L1 cache, and, well, 4 more cache hits from L2 cache for a total of 12. So we get around 8 real cache misses if we do this frequently. For the first access, we get all 20 cache misses. And this probably is another excellent point for all the kernel hackers here. The memory does not belong to you. It belongs to the user space. Don't use it. It's not yours. It's not mine. It's someone else's. So if we actually want to use all of L1 and L2, we are making a mistake. But assuming we could use it all, then these numbers would be true. We try to make our data structures as small as possible so we don't flush the cache, so we don't get this effect. Pages. 4 gigabyte of memory means 1 million pages, for example. Dentry cache. And even when the number of objects is smaller, you get reasonably close. No, 4 gigabytes. 4 gigabytes divided by 4K page size. Yeah. Makes almost exactly 1 million, a binary million. We do have some data structures in that order. And I used to give this presentation for mostly non-kernel hackers who usually also get similar data sets. And yeah, so basically the skip list is a lot better than normal linked lists. Going down from 1 million or so to 20 is a significant improvement. And this is already in the order we want to have. The big problem is we effectively get a single object per cache line when reading it, and we want to do something better than that. There's a second variant of the list, which is the double linked list, which Linux has excellent support for. And the double linked list doesn't really look that much different from a single linked list, except that you need 2 pointers per object. But there's one huge advantage to it, which is? Excellent. Assuming you already have the object. If you have to look up the object first, you need to walk half the list. If you have the object through some other means, then removal is two cache misses for the 2 cache lines adjacent. Right. If you have the object through some other means, this is perfect. And basically, for least recently used LRU ordering, where you don't keep the list sorted by some number, but the sorting of the list is the actual information you care about. For this, a double linked list is quite useful. If you're basically asking, give me page number 17, then a double linked list is stupid. But for some things, if you will look up the object through some other means, a double linked list may be useful. As soon as you want to look up through the double linked list, don't do it. Excellent. Any more questions to linked lists? Before we go on, William, what? Excel lists? I don't know about them.
Oh, you take the 2 pointers. Don't you get
With an XOR list, what you do is you take your 2 pointers, it's a doubly linked list, and you XOR them together, thus allowing you to store 2 pointers in the space of 1 pointer. You can't walk to arbitrary positions in this list. You have to start either at the head or the tail of the list. So it is somewhat specialized. It's not a general purpose thing. But by having one end of the list, you can walk your way down it.
I'm sorry?
I actually don't know.
Okay. Interesting. I learned something new. And I believe it is a bad idea again, because that requires you to walk the entire list and take your 1 million or so cache misses.
It's got some of the bad features of single lists, some of the bad features of double lists.
Right. Nice combination. Combining bad features is always great. Okay. Let's move on to hash tables. Hash tables are more or less arrays, except that you don't use an array to take the object itself, but you use an array to use your management data structure, which is essentially just a single pointer. And in the most basic form, this is a hash table. You have pointers that actually point to objects, or pointers that may be null. And usually, you have a problem with this approach because your hash table may not be big enough. So you need some way of dealing with more objects than fit into your hash table. And also, you may get a hash collision. You may usually you take a hash function to find your index in the array. And this hash function folds a large keyed space into a small keyed space, and you get collisions sooner or later. So you need to handle those collisions in one way or another. Some people propose to do double hashing, also they call it, and just pick a different slot in the hash table. But the usual answer to this is called a linked list. Or a doubly linked list. You can get it circular, you can get it non-circular, some variant of a linked list. And this is giving me a bit of a problem to discuss a hash table. Because how long does it take? Well, it depends, as always. Depends on how big your hash table is compared to the number of objects you have in it. If your hash table is reasonably big compared to the number of objects, and you have on average just a 10% fill rate of your hash table, then you're fairly good. You have a single cache miss to get the actual pointer. And well, on average, you get 0.1 extra cache miss because on 10% of those pointers, you get a collision and you need to take a further look and basically get the second object from the linked list. But usually, that's not the case. So you're pretty close to a single cache miss for every lookup, which is good. Not so good, the pointers per object. You get 10 pointers for every single object by definition if your hash table is this sparse, plus a bit more depending on what data structure you use to handle collisions. If it is a single linked list, you get one more pointer per object. Double linked list, two more pointers, whatever data structure it may be. May also be a tree, maybe anything. How many objects fit into one cache line? Well, since you can get 32 pointers per cache line and you have 10% fill, it's more or less 3. But again, we cannot expect to find an adjacent cache line in any time soon. So effectively, on every single lookup, we take the full cache line and we ignore everything we got except for one pointer, which is inefficient. Fanout is excellent. Basically, we can reach almost ignoring the couple of hash collisions. We can access almost all our objects. That's pretty good. And basically, L1 and L2 cache will not help us at all. Every single access is going to memory. Well, you get maybe 0.001 cache hits or something like that. Basically, zero. But then things start to fill up. When your hash table is roughly 50% full, you will more often have to walk the linked list a bit. And you get, on average, 1.5 or so cache misses for anything you do. You are using your memory a lot more efficient. You only have 2 pointers in the hash table now, plus x, whatever your data structure is, so possibly 4 or so. You get more objects per cache line, and if your hash table is small enough, it may fit into one of the caches. Usually, if you get a million objects, probably it won't be small enough. And fanout, well, what's the fanout? Initially, it's good, and then you have a linked list where the fanout is 1. I don't know a good answer to that. So it's getting better in memory overhead. Small data structures are always good, but it's getting worse for the lookups. And now we have a full hash table. How many objects do we have to walk in the linked list? Depends on how full is. The hash table itself is already full, and then as you add more objects, the linked lists get longer and longer, and things get worse and worse. Our memory overhead is fairly good. Basically, we have one extra to whatever the linked list is giving us. But basically, what we wanted to get from a hash table is fast lookup, fast insert remove, and that is getting slow now. We are getting closer to linked list performance, and we still have some extra memory overhead. So which one is it? 10%, 50%, 100%, 200, 500? Maybe. Which one is it? Okay. Oh, you can resize your hash table. Yes. Now you have a hash table that is a megabyte in size. And you notice it's not big enough. You have more objects. You can resize it. Keeps down your linked lists. You allocate 2 megabytes. Any kernel hacker seeing a problem with that? And even if you get this memory, you now have to move 500,000 objects from, well, probably a bit less, but a large number of objects from one hash table to the other and free the memory for the first hash table. Right. You have a new table, your hash needs to change. Well, maybe you can play tricks and reuse this. No, not really. You but then you would also, if you did that, you would also need to store the key itself next to the pointer, so your overhead would grow again. And the latency will be, well, all you people will love you. You may get away with doing this in user space, but in the kernel, it's a big, big, big no-no. Yes. We already do it? Great. Yes, you can basically keep both hash tables around and then do both lookups until you're finished and you can remove the old one, which basically means you can double these numbers. What? For a certain amount of time, yes. You still have the problem of finding a megabyte or so of memory somewhere. Yes, vmalloc on a large memory i386 is always fun. Well, you need to double the memory you need for the table itself. True, okay. Then you can add 1 point something small to it. Oh, yes. Yes. So we can have a lot of fun with hash tables. And actually, at SELF, people were talking about shaving some 5 bytes or 20 bytes and maybe even 100 bytes off various places of the kernel. They took a quick look at how much memory we occupy with hash tables. And I found just 5 hash tables, maybe there's more, I didn't find any more, that are initialized at boot up. And the size depends. For 64-bit, of course, we have larger pointers, so you would expect to double the memory. It's not exactly doubling because some have extra data structures that are 32-bit on both architectures. And the networking area, yes, it does everything. It also decides to pick a different size for the hash table depending on how much memory you have. I mean, obviously, if I have a huge number cruncher, I need a bigger routing hash than if I have a small router. That's makes sense, I know. So basically, depending on which, how much memory you have and whether you are 32-bit or 64-bit, you can have somewhere between 380k and 2.5 megabytes of memory going into your hash tables on boot up. As of September, I haven't looked in the 4 months in between. As of September, there are two steps. If you are above 500 megabytes of RAM, then you get the larger size. If you're below, you get the smaller size. If you go to a terabyte or 50 terabytes, it doesn't change. So it's a very coarse granularity. Maybe SGI has extra patches for this. I don't know. But yeah, the kernel is playing guesswork games at compile time, how much memory you may use, or actually at boot up time with the memory installed in the system. It may guess well. It may not guess so well. At least as long as the hash tables are always too big, it's only wasted memory. If they ever get too small, the performance will get down. But I haven't looked closely enough at the networking code. How the hash tables are scaling when they get full? OK, so the So if you allow me to sum it up in one sentence, whenever you hear the terms hash table and dynamic in one sentence, it doesn't work. Hash tables are more or less like arrays. As long as you know your data, the size of your data set, you are well off. But as soon as you cannot guess it well enough, you have a huge problem. You're always off on one end or the other, or possibly on both. OK, balanced trees. Has anyone seen this somewhat balanced tree before? This is exactly what balanced trees are supposed to be not. The problem with the binary tree is that you have one or two pointers that are set, or maybe at the leaf, zero. But for the non-leaf nodes, you have either one or two pointers set. Yeah, OK. Another mistake spotted by Willy. The arrows should only go one way. Sorry about that. Or we can add a parent pointer, but usually you don't want for a binary tree. The problem is you may have nodes that only have a single child. If you have a single child, you are back to the linked list. And we remember the numbers from the linked lists and shut out once and decide we don't want to go there. So this case needs to be avoided at all costs. You may only ever have nodes that have two or more children. So that basically rules out the binary tree. What people came up with as the basically elementary balance tree was the so-called 2-3-4 tree. Actually, a 2-3 tree would also work, but people preferred the 2-3-4 tree, where you have four pointers per node, and the invariant is that you always have at least two set, except for the leaf nodes. And then the leaf nodes actually point to the data objects, so even for those, you have two set. You may have three or four set, but never one, and never zero. And the second trick they are playing with these is when you grow and you you occupy this third pointer, well, that's easy. When you add one more object and you need the fourth pointer, again, that's easy. When you need a fifth pointer, you have a problem. And you basically allocate a new object. And you move the fifth pointer to the new object. And of course, now it would only have a single pointer. That doesn't work. So you move two pointers out, and you have a three node and a two node. But that means you have a new node here somewhere, and you need to add it somewhere. So you add a new node to the next layer up. And as you keep adding objects, you keep adding objects further up in the tree. And if... Oh, what is that? Oh. That was not what I intended to do. Come on. If you ever run out of objects in the top, you grow a new root node, and you grow everything from the top. The big thing about balance trees is you never grow from the leaves. You always grow from the root. That means every single path has the same length. The distance between any leaf and the root is always identical. It's always balanced. And we actually have one balanced tree in the kernel called the red-black tree, just like the black-red cap we have in our swag. And this is a binary tree, if I'm not mistaken. How does that work? How can you have a balanced binary tree? Actually, it is not a binary tree. Instead, it is a 2-3-4 tree that you make look like a binary tree. And here you actually do it, get the pointers up. And what you are doing, I should use the mouse, is you take up to three nodes and make them behave as if they were a single node. So you get 1, 2, 3, 4 child pointers. And you may have fewer nodes. Where do we have it? Here. Here we have only two nodes. So we have 1, 2, 3 child pointers. Here we have just a single one. So we have 1, 2 child pointers, just like a 2-3-4 tree. And now the question is, which of these nodes belong to a supernode and which don't? And for that, we have the color, which is hardly recognizable. In this case, the red color means we are crossing the boundary to a new node, and the black color means we are staying within one supernode. I think in the kernel, it's vice versa. I'm not sure. It doesn't really matter. It's whatever you do. So this is a balance tree disguised as a binary tree, which means as a binary tree, it is semi-balanced. The longest distance from the root and the shortest distance from the root may be off by a factor of 2, because you can have the small step here with the small nodes and the large step here with the large node. But it is pretty close to balanced. If it was actually a balanced binary tree, you would get 20 lookups. It is slightly imbalanced, so I did some back of an envelope calculations, and it came out to about 25. And the problem is that your fanout is not 2, but it's actually the square root of 3, at least in my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong. And yes, you also, to manage this red-black tree, you need the up pointer, so you need 3 pointers for every object. So we are slightly more inefficient than a linked list. But again, we are back to logarithmic performance. 25 is not exactly great, but it's better than a linked list. And
you didn't show these stats for the 2-3-4 state. Does that have an up pointer at the price point as well?
You don't need a parent pointer. If you don't take a parent pointer, you have to walk from the top again. So once you're doing the split or emerge, you are getting into quadratic performance, which is quadratic to the height of the tree. So log n squared, something like that. If you do have a parent pointer, then you get faster and you are log n. And I didn't have the numbers for the 2-3-4 tree because nobody ever uses it. That simple. People do use the red-black tree because they like binary trees for some reason. And actually, we would need one extra field if David Woodhouse, one of the Davids from Red Hat, hadn't played a trick and put the one bit for the color information into one of the pointers, into one of the lower bits of the pointers. If you don't want to play these tricks, you need 4 fields. But still, 25 is not nearly as good as a hash table could theoretically be. It may be better than a hash table that is significantly overfilled. And we have one tree that is actually a lot better, which we call a radix tree. No one else does. If you take a look at literature and look up for a radix tree, you will find something completely different. Unless you get this pointer to Linux Weekly News, where John Covey described the Linux radix tree, which is actually more or less what the standard Unix file systems, FFS and so on, used for their inode format. Basically, you have at the bottom layer an array indexed linearly, just like the array at the very beginning. But the array is not as big as your complete object space is. So next you have an array that is pointing to every 4th object, or it's actually pointing to the array of objects, and so on and so on. And in the Linux case, I believe it's 256 objects you have on every single one of these nodes. What? 64? Okay. Still, fairly large number. 64 didn't really fit well onto the slides anymore, so I used 4. And this is actually, it is not a balanced tree at all, but it behaves as if it was. If you have a large cluster at some place and then nothing, then you get a lot of data pushed on the left side and nothing on the right. That's a bit odd. Still, the distance from any leaf to the root is identical, so that's good, unless it's a Unix file, Unix inode format, where you have those fast links to the beginning, but that's a special case. And radix trees are surprisingly efficient, as long as you are doing sequential stuff. When you're walking just from one object to the next, you will notice that these are the objects per cache line, and those are the pointers per object. Actually, those numbers depend on how you access them. As long as things are going sequentially, you get 32 pointers in every cache line, or 16 if you're on a 64-bit platform. That means for every time you pull a cache line into memory, you can access 32 objects, so on average you need 0.03 cache misses for every object. And you have the odd chance of having to pull 2 cache lines because you walk up the tree, but that's somewhere in the jitter. So it would be 0.0298 instead of 0.097 something, doesn't matter. Extremely efficient. This is better than a hash table. The hash table is the most efficient data structure you will ever find in literature, because they assume every single access to memory is the same, has the same cost. But in reality, a radix tree is more efficient than a hash table, as long as we're walking it sequentially. And it's way more efficient than anything else, basically. It is not so efficient for random case. Basically, the random case depends on how big is your key space. I assumed for these numbers, 32 bits, and for 32 bits, and if you use one cache line for each node, you get to, on average, 6.4 cache misses. If your key is actually 64-bit, you can double these numbers and you get 12 cache misses. If your key is something even larger, if you take a large string or something like that, the cache misses will get large. So that's not too good. As long as your key space is small, say as long as you use it for an address space and your file is not 4 billion pages long, but your file is actually just a megabyte long, you only have two or maybe three levels of the tree. And one more trick, because you already know which pointer you will access, you will only ever touch a single pointer in this node, so you can actually make this node larger than a cache line. 64 elements is more than fits into a cache line, even on 32-bit with the biggest currently produced cache lines. Okay, 390 is special again. Okay, except for 390, it is bigger than any cache line we ever find. But you still only need to access one of those cache lines. The other one you don't access. So having a fairly large fanout works well. And yeah, the pointers per object, you need a single pointer per object. And then for every 32 objects, you need one more pointer in the next table up and so on. So it's pretty close to one. Things get pretty bad when you're going random, because at least at the bottom layers, you will only ever use a single pointer in the node. When you're getting close to the top, you will have them fully populated. But at the bottom, you only use a single pointer. And your memory overhead is pretty bad. Which also means you you will use your cache fairly inefficiently. And these misses also evict a certain amount of the cache. Oh, yes, and the top couple of layers always fit into the caches. So even if you have a random access for a fully populated 32-bit space, you only get close to four cache misses. So that's still fairly good. Even on a random case, which is bad for a radix tree, you are pretty similar to a somewhat overloaded hash table. Dave M., you're listening? Okay. You may get some problems with locking, theoretically. I'm not sure. I ignored locking for these slides. Okay, let's move on to one of the many, many, many B-trees. A B-tree is almost like a radix tree, except that you in the radix tree, you have these implicit numbers, the index. And in the B-tree, you make these numbers explicit. You may skip one or two of them. And you say which number, which index this actually is. And at the next node up, you basically say index 2 or anything below goes to this node. Index 8 or anything below, which is larger than 2, goes to this node, and so on. And you throw it up more and more layers, which means if your key space is populated fairly sparsely, you don't need to waste a complete node for a single key. You can stuff more objects into your nodes. Which means for random access, well, also basically this is the 2-3-4 tree, except that you multiply 2-3-4 by a fairly large number. And I assumed, again, I make a node as large as the cache line. And now I can fit 16 objects in a cache line, theoretically. But because we always have these splits going on, in the worst case, they are only 50% populated. So we get 8 objects per cache line. Actually, the sequential case causes them to get only 50% populated, because you always split, and one half that you split off, you will never add anything to this half that you just split off. And the second half, you grow, split it off again, and so on. So the sequential case is actually the worst case for a B-tree. In a random case, which is a lot better, you get somewhere between 50% and 100% full, so you're 75% full on average. And lookup for a B-tree is fairly similar to Redix tree lookup. The higher layers you always have in the cache, so ignore those. And at the bottom, you need to grab a new cache line every 8 objects, so it's still fairly efficient. Random in this case no longer depends on your key space. It depends on the number of objects you have in your tree. If you don't have this many objects in your tree, those numbers go down. These numbers are for a million objects. And if your key space is 64-bit instead of 32-bit, then, okay, the key is a bit larger, so we cannot stuff quite as many into the cache line anymore. That should be, I guess, 9 or so, 9 or 10, this number. But we're still pretty close to those 5 or 6 or so. Worst case, if you generate a case that leaves every single node half full but doesn't walk it sequentially, you can get a bit worse, but it's still in the same order. And I calculated you would get somewhere between 2.5 and 3 and 3.6 cache hits from your L1 or L2 cache, assuming it all belongs to you, which it usually doesn't. So a B-tree is a bit worse than a Radix tree for sequential. It definitely has a lot more overhead for sequential, and it is significantly better for the random case, although in these numbers it is just a small step, but it is independent of your key space. That's good. And if your tree is small, then these numbers also go vastly down, and you are pretty close to zero, which means, in my opinion, if you ever use a hash table and you haven't thought about a B-tree, you might want to think about it. Correct. Correct. Yes. And that's actually why there are so many of them. Sorry, I couldn't hear that. True. Locking is easier on some data structures than on others. Coming from the RCU person, I fully agree. It would be insane not to. Right. The locking is actually one of the reasons why I haven't sent patches yet. I am a bit afraid of it as well. Yes, I dare say. But I still think it's a worthy goal not to try to scale the hash tables, but instead to use a tree of some form. And yes, maybe I'm full of it and this will bounce. Yes, I am.
It's just, I think I was saying that simplifying the talk is fine, but it's, you venture into criticizing a useful simple data structure while ignoring the currency.
Yep. That's actually what some of these variants of the B-tree are for. As Dave Chinner said, removal is the complicated part, which my implementation of B-trees actually has avoided because I don't merge on remove. I'm lazy. There's one variant, I have no idea what it should be called. I don't think they gave a name for it in the paper from some IBM guys at Haifa, which basically I think we should get back to the 2-3-4 tree to explain it. In the 2-3-4 tree, when we do it split, afterwards we have to go recursively back up and do it split of potentially have to split this node as well, and this node, and so on. So once we take locking into the picture, we have to keep a lock for the complete tree, and we can only release the lock once we have done the full split, or the full merge, or the full operation, which doesn't scale very well across many CPUs. One of the tricks these Haifa people did was, if there is the chance that we may have to split, we'd split. Even if we don't have to this time, we may have to, and we don't look if this is going to happen, we do it anyway. And afterwards, we can release the lock for this load and for this node and take the lock for the next node down. Which is smart, but it also means that you are splitting and merging a lot more often. One of the tricks with the B-tree is that you always have some hysteresis, and you want to make it split and emerge a rare operation. And if you do this preemptively, you have to leave more difference between it split and emerge, and that effectively means that on average you have fewer objects in each node. So then these numbers become worse. There's always a drawback. But still, Chris Mason is using exactly this for ButterFS. And after I read the paper, I agree that anyone doing B-trees should implement this variant. It's very efficient. Okay. Yeah. The cow stuff is, well, anyway. Yeah. Dancing tree is actually a variant from Hans Reiser, from Reiser 4. It's a very fancy name for something very simple. You split, but you don't merge. And you leave all the merges for some later point of time, which in the case of Reiser 4 is when you write out to the disk. But it can be anything. It's basically you do a garbage collection run at some point later, which also means your garbage collection run may take a long time and you get into latency problems. There's the very original B minus tree, some people call it, where you have pointers to the objects from the inner nodes, and basically this is a stupid idea, don't do it. The B plus tree has the object pointers only in the leaf nodes, which is the only way you ever want to do a B tree. I think the B hash tree is instead of splitting, you take a look at one of the neighbors, and if you can move an object to a neighbor, you do it. Problem is, you now also have to change the pointer of your parent to if you move the 7 over to the left, you also have to change this number to be a 7 now. So that's getting more complicated, and especially with locking, it's probably a bad idea. The B star tree doesn't take one object and split it into two, but it takes two objects and splits it into three, so on average they are a bit fuller, but again, you have to do more work for the parents, so probably bad idea. And that's the variants I know, there's probably 10 more. Yes. What Dave said and what I ignored previously was that most implementations, or many textbook implementations at least, of B-trees have the pointer to the next sibling node to the right. So you can sequentially walk them, and maybe even to the next one to the left as well. One of the reasons why I completely ignored this is that it's built on the assumption that your data structure doesn't move. I am one of those people who create a copy and write file system, so if I ever update this node, I write it to some other place in memory, and then I would have to update both of the siblings as well, which is prohibitive. So I don't do it. I only have a pointer from the top. If you keep your data structures in place, as XFS does and most traditional file systems do, that's fine. For in-memory data structure, it may be fine, but then your cache line again gets somewhat cramped. It's a trade-off.
One place you do use this next trick in kernel memory data structures is of course the VMAs, where you need training skills for the next VMA rather than walk back down the tree to just have the next pointer.
Yep. Also, you get some optimizations when your nodes get very large. If your file system and your nodes actually reside on the disk, they are usually 4K or so in size. And once they are 4K in size and you are looking for something inside the node, you may want to do bisecting. As long as they are just a single cache line, you just go linearly through them. And even when bisecting, once you have a certain interval, you can just go linearly faster. And possibly one more trick is the CPU caches are fairly good for read ahead. So you can make these B-tree nodes larger than the cache line, and you may get extra cache misses, but these extra cache misses are cheaper than the initial random cache miss. So having a bigger node and a bigger fan out may actually be reasonably cheap. And for a disk, again, read ahead works well. And actually, in the case of a disk, it doesn't matter if you read 4K or a megabyte. That's basically the same cost. You can make your nodes as large as possible. But for memory, 128 bytes is already fairly small. You may want to go larger. For a disk, 4K, that's reasonably big. And basically, if you take a look at these numbers and at these numbers and see one of them is excellent for sequential workloads or for having a dense cluster somewhere, the radix tree. And one of them is excellent for a data structure that is very sparsely populated, which is the B tree. One may get the idea of actually doing both. And just spend one more piece of the cache line and add a small header somewhere here and say, this node you should interpret as a radix tree node, or this node you should interpret as a B-tree node, which makes the handling fairly complicated and hairy. But you can save memory and get the best of two worlds. And I believe there is an implementation of this. Yes, looking at the man page. Some people have done it before. There's actually four variants, and this is not too bad. They have one variant, which is an optimization if you just want to put a single bit into it. In that case, you don't need a pointer. You just, at least at the leaf node, you don't need a pointer, so you can save some memory. You have the variant where you have a word and a pointer. You have a variant where you take a string as your key. You have a variant where you take a byte stream of a certain length as your key. That's simple. So GDL should be the straightforward one. And yes, this is how you use a GDL tree. Oh, the code is matching this, yes. It's It wasn't this much code. It would probably also get a obfuscated C contest nomination, but it's just too big. Anyone can go obfuscated in a megabyte or so. Right.
But and they managed to wrap it in a ton of obfuscated PDFs and directly type those this compressed.
Yeah.
You have to remember these were HPUX people. They have a different cultural heritage.
Willie suffered HP long enough to know. Fair enough, but is that a reason to use two and three and four letter abbreviations with as few vowels as you can possibly find, and the first two letters always being identical? I mean, this comment to the right should be the function name and not a comment. I moved out of medicine. I don't know. Yes, good point. But well, PJL array, that's 8 characters, yes? Could be. No. Yeah. The idea behind it is really excellent. The implementation, I would dump and do it again. I wouldn't even try to pull the interesting bits from it. But the idea behind it is really impressive.
I think you're right to want to dump the current implementation, but a huge amount of the complexity in the current implementation is Doug and the other three guys working on it finding all the corner cases.
True.
And I think you will end up with something that's maybe half as complex. You'll start with something 10% as complex, but by the time you've got all the little corner cases, you are going to have quadrupled the complexity of what you started with.
Possibly, quite likely, yes.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, they went too far around the elbow, absolutely.
Yeah. I would really love to have something like this done well, or someone cleaning it up. What?
Yeah, the patterns are not our GPLI.
Okay.
Not a problem.
Not a problem for us. So, yeah. If someone has a year or 10 to spare, this would be an excellent project. And for those of us who don't have this time, I believe some people at SGI have a library for B-trees that works well for memory. I also have one of those libraries, but mine, I would prefer someone else to do it well. I don't have the merge at all, which is fair enough for my users. There's, at the moment, there's the SGI implementation. Peter Zeistra did one implementation. I did one implementation. I'm not sure about SGI. I haven't seen the code, but Peter's implementation has some drawbacks. Mine has other drawbacks. And in my case, I didn't care about lockless either. I take a single lock outside of the B-tree code itself, which is fine for my use cases. So I don't know, maybe we will end up with several implementations. And one can also easily end up with several implementations if the key is a U64 or a long or something like that. And possibly, going back to Judy, one of the interesting tricks is taking this array of bytes with a fixed length as a key. We can get a special case for U64 and long, which is the common cases, but Zach needs two U64 and one U8, and in that case, just turn your key into a string of bytes and use that. It's also, one thing, the red-black tree takes callbacks for doing the comparison, which is sane for the red-black tree. If you took a callback to do the comparison for a B-tree, you would actually have to load every single one of these objects hanging off the B-tree to do the comparison. And that would mean your performance in the B-tree would be worse than a red-black tree, where the goal should be to be better. So having a string of bytes and doing the comparison in the B-tree code itself and having the complete key encoded as part of the B-tree is important. So if you ever think about a callback and a B-tree, don't do it. Time out? 5 minutes left. Good. Callbacks in principle are not bad, but if the callbacks have to fetch the object, then you have a performance problem. As long as you don't fetch the object and don't fetch extra cache lines, that's fine. I'm not sure. Let's talk about that later. Any other questions? Non-SGI questions, maybe. T3, is that the two-dimensional one, or?
No, it's, in order to look at the key, you end up having less copies of the key throughout the tree, the database does.
Okay.
So when you do your thing, you want to get the key saves.
Okay.
So, not all fixed ones to do, but
yeah.
When you can put a team of 10 guys on it, you get some echo percentage.
Yeah, one optimization you can do is you, instead of storing the complete key, you store the offset from this key, which means you can usually pack it smaller. It also gives you some constraints, so maybe you need to add extra nodes just to so you don't run out of your offset space. So it's in a way you get some of the drawbacks of radix tree back. I guess that's what it is. It's a fairly reasonably obvious optimization. Ben. Yes. And you're playing a very dangerous game. Has everyone heard it, or should I repeat it? Basically, couple of these pointers fit into one cache line, and instead of taking the linked list approach for overflows, you overflow into the next couple of pointers on the same that usually are on the same cache line. That works fairly well. It also means you need to rescale your hash table so it's always sufficiently bigger than the number of objects you store. And there's one drawback. If your hash function is not sufficiently randomizing, and you tend to get lots of hashes that are in the low numbers, say, then you always overflow into slots that are already occupied. Okay. Ah, okay, yes. Okay. That's what some of the networking code is doing as well. It is storing the log, the spin log, and some extra information in the same slot as, well, next to the pointer.